Hey everybody, it's Laurie McKenna and this is Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. How is your partial lockdown summer going out there? Have you gotten in any arguments or maybe even fistfights lately at the supermarket with your fellow citizens over the partisan battle of whether or not to wear a face mask? COVID-19, the hit pandemic that's sweeping the nation. We are a strange and silly folk, us Americans, aren't we? I hope you had a good 4th of July. Mine was nice. Lots of swell all weekend long here in sunny Southern California. Good fun with the kiddos. Topped it off with a nice little barbecue. Nothing fancy, just burgers and dogs. We had the in-laws over and sat in the backyard, 6 feet apart, of course. It was kind of the first time we've entertained in months, really, since this whole sort of lockdown, quasi-lockdown thing kicked in. And it felt really good, man. I realized how much I miss humans. I miss you people. So come on, folks. Where is your sense of community? Let's quit our bitching and keep washing those hands and keeping your distance. And for Christ's sake, do not sing indoors. It's very dangerous. We will beat this thing someday. Together. Stick together. All right, let's talk about Zounds.com. Did you know that Zounds.com has free shipping on every single order? No exceptions, no exclusions, even crazy heavy items like tube amps, 8x10 speaker cabs, giant synth boards, drum kits, whatever. It's all ships free over there at Zounds.com. So get on over there and visit our friends at the Zounds.com. Okay, let's get to the interview. Okay, so I am so excited that I finally got to interview Laurie McKenna. I have been obsessed with her music ever since Burn the Rifle came out and have bugged her here and there over the years when I've run into her to come on the show. And if you aren't familiar with Laurie, stop whatever it is you're doing and go listen to all her records right now. I swear to God, you won't be sorry. There's a real magic in what she does, like her voice, the melancholy lyrics and melodies, and the beautiful Dave Cobb production. It's all incredible. But not only does she make great solo records, she's also a top Music Row songwriter with lots and lots of cuts under her belt. Although, interestingly, she's never lived anywhere near Music Row and had a pretty unorthodox entry into sort of the mainstream country music world of songwriters. And she explains all that here in our conversation. And I should also mention that her new record, The Balladeer, comes out July 24th, and you can get a sneak peek at a couple of those tunes off the record that are streaming now. So this is Laurie McKenna on Walking the Floor.
Even when you're my age,
I hate listening to my own voice just altogether. But I listened to several of your episodes, and they were all great. So,
thank you.
You're being hard on yourself.
So. Well, you know, I got to tell you, I've been wanting to interview you for so long. I'm so excited that we're finally doing this.
Thanks for doing this.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's just jump in. You're based up in Massachusetts, like where you grew up, right?
Yeah, I live like 20 miles south of Boston.
Oh, okay. I mean, I guess my first question is, where's your chatter accent? But then the other question, you don't sound, I'm all my sort of Massachusetts knowledge is informed by like Mighty Mighty Boston songs and, you know, cultural stereotypes, which you don't seem to fit neatly into.
That's probably fair. I literally fake a Southern accent because when I started singing, like in a studio, people would be like, hey, do you know that you don't pronounce your R's? Or what word is that you're trying to sing? And I had all these problems with it where I didn't know that I had a speech problem until I started singing in the studio. And so it seemed natural. This is like way before Nashville. It just seemed natural for me to, the only way I could pronounce my R's was to fake a Southern accent. So.
Well, did you move to Nashville and sort of get your career established and then move back to Massachusetts, or have you always been there?
Yeah, I've always lived here, and I've always lived here, and I've just like flown back and forth. And it's funny because we just bought a condo like last fall down there finally, because two of our kids live there now. Mm. But I'm there all the time, and I miss it when I'm not there. Like, I feel like part of me lives in Nashville, but I literally live in the same town I've always lived in.
Well, I mean, how did you pull that off? That seems like that must be very unusual for somebody that does what you do to not actually be based in Nashville, at least a lot of the time, or, you know, have started there or whatever.
I know. Well, it turns out that I'm exceptionally lucky. I had a lot of lucky things happen to me. So we never moved there because the kids were always in school. Like, we have five kids, are all over the place in age range and everything. And it just never made sense for my husband to leave his job, which is like a union job, like a really good job, you know. And it never, like, when finally you say, oh, I can make enough money that I can bring my family there. Like, by that point, the kids were all over the place in college, high school, like everywhere. And right. I can't have someone else like suffer for my songs. You know what I mean? Right. Like,
when it's your kids.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't do it. It's never was, you know, a part of the program for me. I just wasn't ever going to do that. And so I never really felt the availability to put that pressure on everybody else to say, hey, my life would be way easier if we lived in Nashville. Are you guys cool with suffering a little bit so my life is easier? Like, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, so do you do most of your songwriting work remotely anyway? Like, is your particular situation sort of like perfectly suited to this coronavirus lockdown world that we're living in now?
Well, I have always written on like Skype or FaceTime or things like that, like a couple of times a month maybe. But I have writers that come up here, probably like if I have the whole week off and I'm not traveling or not doing any shows, my publisher will be like, hey, you know, so-and-so says they want to come up, you know, and they'll come up for 3 days. Like, Haley Witters will come up and stay in a hotel up the street, or she'll spend a couple of days in Boston and then, you know, write with me for a couple of days before she goes home. And a lot of times people are on tour up here, so like I'll go meet them at the show, and that works out. And I still write alone a lot, but not as, I enjoy co-writing. I never co-wrote a song until I was 36 years old, but I love it. I love it. It's like, to me, co-writing just opened like a thousand doors in my head for music. And but other than that, I usually go to Nashville twice a month, sometimes three times a month. But I'll go down, like, I literally just think of like a Southwest flight as like my, you know, my Prius. Like, I'll just like,
that's your commute,
the worst thing. Yeah. But I'll be like, I'm just gonna jump down for the day, and then I'll come, you know what I mean, like I'll go down for the damn day even, and just come back. So I'm back and forth a lot.
Because of, what am I trying to say? Because of your sort of unique situation in that way, did you sort of skip the part of the Music Row songwriting career of like sitting in rooms with people you don't know, doing those 3-hour sessions, you know, the, sort of slogging away, right? Like, did you not have to kind of endure that part of a writer's life?
Yeah, I totally, these are the pieces that I understand now that I know how Nashville works. Is the reason I got a publishing deal was because I made a record called Bitter Town in 2004. My friend Mary Gaucher, maybe you know Mary as well, she's one of the best songwriters we have. She's a brilliant songwriter. We kind of came up together in the Boston community. She gave my record to a publisher named Melanie Howard. Melanie liked it, gave it to Missy Gallimore. Missy Gallimore gave it to Faith Hill. So I got four Faith Hill cuts before I had a publishing deal. And that's how I got in, like, that was my introduction to Nashville. So it was kind of like, I always compare it to, like, it's like I won the lottery, but I didn't play. I didn't buy a ticket. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Somebody just showed, like, not literally, practically knocked on my door. And obviously it was Mary, you know, it was like the guardian angel and all this, but somebody just knocked on my door and said, "Hey, Faith Hill wants to cut some of your songs." So that's how I got my deal. And I ended up with a publishing deal through that and a label deal for a while. But so when I started, so I had never co-written a song. So my publisher, who was Melanie Howard at the time, was like, "Yeah, everybody here co-writes songs." And I knew people around town that had co-written, like Mary co-wrote songs, Josh Ritter co-wrote songs. I knew people that did it. I just didn't know how it worked. Like, it just seemed so unnatural to me. But they put me, the first co-write I had was, one of the first was Mark D. Sanders. So I did do that thing where you end up in a room with someone you don't know, just because I didn't know anybody in Nashville. But they put me with the best people that knew I had never co-written a song. Like, I learned from Mark D. Sanders and Liz Rose and Pat McLaughlin. Like, I learned from people, and Brandi Clark was one of my first co-writes too.
Oh,
but she
really?
Had been doing it for so long. She was like a baby, but she had been doing it for so long and co-writing. Like, I got to learn and experience that through the best people, you know? So it was such a blessing.
What was the immediate aftermath of Faith Hill doing a few of your songs on that record? Like, did the floodgates just open?
I mean, it seemed to me they did. I mean, it was like, you know, I got signed to Warner Brothers for a while, made a record with them that Tim and Byron Gallimore produced, and I just got to see how that whole world ran, and I got to go on tour with Tim and Faith, and so it was like I was playing in church basements in 2004. I was playing in the Northeast in church basements, and by 2000, I think that tour was 2007. I was, you know, opening up arenas for Tim and Faith, me and my guitar player, Mark Arelli, you know what I mean? It was like, it was this crazy, like, compare, like, these two different worlds, but they always kind of made sense to me, that I just knew they were just two different doors,
right.
But they're all music. So it kind of, like, one didn't change the other all the way, you know what I mean? Everything seemed like it was like a slow moving process, even though it was like, it was a little bit like floodgates.
Like, what was the scene that you came up with when you're talking about playing in church basements? Was that like a country music world? Was that more singer songwriter folk? Like, what was?
Yeah. Around here, it's like, we called it folk at the time, but I'm not really a folk musician. Like, I'm not like, I'm more of like a domestic songwriter. But the community we have here is based around this venue called Passine, which at the time was Club Passine, which has been around for years and years and years. And, you know, like, Stevie Nicks played there before she was in Fleetwood Mac. And, like, Dylan, you know, came up through there. And everybody that's a great songwriter has played in Passim, and it's a legendary, it's like our Bluebird. Like, if Nashville right. has the Bluebird, we have, and I'm sure LA, you know, every big, you know, music place has that room. And for here, it's Passim, and I came up with in that world. And literally, I remember that tour in 2007, we did like 19 shows with Tim and Faith. And the last show that I did was like July 4th weekend or something. And the next day, the next morning, I was on stage at Passine with my band, like, playing like a brunch. And it somehow made sense. Like, it somehow, like, it's like, I can love you and I can love you. Like, like, it was like I had my high school friends and my camp friends, and they,
right,
they never
right.
really met each other. They didn't meet each other for a long time, but I'm like, my high school friends, I'm like, you're going to love my camp friends.
That's a funny thing. I've had that experience many times in life, of like going and supporting a much bigger artist, and then you go back to like reality after that, and you're like, oh, right, it's hard. Right, nobody shows up when it's just me. Damn.
Yeah, I forgot. It's true, but there's something about, like, I always like a smaller room anyway. You know, I have been so blessed to be able to open up for people in those big rooms. But my goal is always, like, I don't put too much pressure on myself about it. My goal is always to, like, I know I'm not going to win them all over. It's just if I can get some of you to listen. Like, when Tim and Faith did the tour again this past couple of years ago, I did the Boston shows for that weekend, and I knew I'm up there singing a Faith Hill cover that I wrote, but I knew that that the audience thinks it's a Faith Hill cover.
Right,
you know what
right,
I mean?
Right, yeah.
I'm not going to even explain it. It's like explaining the music business to your grandfather who's like, are you still writing songs for Faith Hill? And I'm like, yes, I am still writing songs for Faith Hill. You have hard to explain, you know?
I was wondering about that. When you write a song and a big artist cuts it, is there some sort of like, you know, is it frowned on for you to then cut it as well? Do you have to wait a little while? Does it matter? Are people indifferent? Is it encouraged that you cut it? Like, what is the, what's the sort of the accepted sort of rule around that?
I've only really had to like worry about that. It's such a good problem to worry about, but I've only had to worry about it a couple of times, and it's been the timing, just grace of God timing with Humble and Kind and Tim. I'd have to think about it, but he was just putting out the single of Humble and Kind when I was making the record with Dave Cobb. And so I knew that the single, that I could cut the song because the single would have either gone up or down or whatever it was going to do in all those weeks, you know, if it's 25 weeks or whatever. I knew I had all that time. And Tim also knew too, like, out of respect for the artist, you know, always let them know. But I have had a couple of times where I didn't put a song on a record because I thought maybe an artist was going to do it. And every time I've done that, it didn't work out. Like, if the song really is in me and it's going to be one of my 10 songs for the past 2 years, I'll just keep it. You know what I mean? I'll just, you know, cut it anyway. And the only other time it happened was with Little Big Town with Happy People. And I just called Karen and said, they had already been through it. And I said, are you cool if I cut this song now? And I don't get in their way, you know, like, our audiences are so different. There might be a little bit of overlap, like where some of their audience knows me, but it's a small percentage. And I'm never gonna be big enough as an artist to squash a Tim McGraw song. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
So it's always, but Humble and Kind, it was really great timing, because when my record came out, I think his single on it was like top of the chart. So it's just like the timing that works in my favor. You know what I mean? Sure, so the timing is just beautiful there. So
I mean, when you're writing, do you sort of write in batches for your own records, or are you just kind of, like you just kind of said, like, are you, as you're writing, just all the time, you're sort of earmarking, well, maybe that'll be for me. Or do they sort of like fit together thematically? Like, how do you go about figuring out which ones are going to be for your records?
Yeah. So the way that we've done it the last few times is I just keep writing all along. I'm not an everyday writer, but I write at least, you know, maybe once a week. Like, there are some weeks I'll write maybe even 5 songs, but then, you know, then I won't turn in anything for a while. Or so I'm best like 2 or 3 songs a week, you know. It's probably like the best, like, sort of workout for me in songland. If I'm writing too much, I start hating myself. I start hating on my melody. That's why I love co-writing, because I'm like, Chris, I hate this melody. I hate myself. What would you do? You know what I mean? And, but through the whole process, and because I normally have 2 years between records, it's like, when I turn them in, my publishers, I turn in songs to like 7 people are on that list, and they'll come back and they'll be like, this looks like a great one for you or whatever. And then it's not that I earmark them so much, but I go back, and once I have like an anchor, then I'll try to find the other songs that go with that. Like the last record, it was People Get Old. Even though the record was called The Tree, it was People Get Old was the anchor of that record. So to me, like, once I had that, I knew I had something to build a record off of. And for this record, it was When You're My Age. And it was like, I knew I had something to build off of that.
Okay. I was going to ask if it was The Balladeer, just given that it's the title track.
I know. Well, and like The Tree, it's like, I thought The Tree was such a good title because that the last record's called The Tree. And I just loved that process of writing that song and the people I wrote it with and all the things in that song. But this time, making a record and calling it like Larry McKenna when you're my age. Like, Larry McKenna, people get old.
Your publicist and your manager are like, no.
I have the worst titles ever, but The Balladeer, I literally wrote because I loved those words, the ballad. Mm. Like, you know what I mean? But it was just, to me, it was just like a great title for a record and it kind of fitting for me, even though it's not my story.
It's interesting listening to that song because the imagery in it reminded me of like what it felt like on a punk rock van tour, which is very much an environment I struggle to see you in.
Well, it's all made up. I think I was trying to think of like Almost Famous and like all these things. Like I was right. You know how when you're writing and you like stumble across like a character, right. You know, like, and then you build the character. I love the building of the character.
Well, I think there was that line, something about a downtrodden bar with the bleeding hearts or something like that. I was like, I've been there. I know that.
I have been there as well too, but it's like, there's a little bit of me in her because of the fact that I think like, I like sad songs and I like simple songs, but the more I learn about myself and music, I realize I think I like those two things because my voice sounds so sad. My voice has nowhere else to go but sound sad.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing I wanted to ask you about too. Like there's a real like melancholy to a lot of your work. And I think in modern country music, my perception of it is that it tends to be more optimistic in a way, you know, whoever the protagonist in the song is sort of wins ultimately, whether that's in love or driving a bitchin' truck or whatever the thing is, you know what I mean? Like, so like, how do you get your songs? Like, how do your songs get past the censors in Nashville? Cause your songs do not fit into that, you know, that optimism. Exactly.
I've been in so many, like, as I've said, I love co-writing, and I've been in a lot of rooms where I sit down and someone's like, I got this idea. It's about a beach and, you know, and a party. And I'm like, immediately my brain is like, oh, shit. I know nothing about this. I've been to a beach party, but what does it feel like? I don't know what it feels like other than like joy. And where, like, what else can you say? But if you say, oh, I had heard the story about this breakup, I'm like, oh, I like, there's lots of things feeling in there. Let's pick all those apart. Like, let's pull them all up and see what they look like. Where I love party songs and I truly appreciate them because for me, they're really hard to write. And I know a lot of people that would probably say the same thing. And you can tease about it. And I do like, oh, there's more sad words that rhyme and things like that. But it's hard. It's damn hard to write a happy, just a fun loving song. You also need a groove, you know, and I'm not that great at the groove side of things. I wrote a song the other day, earlier this week with Luke Laird. Do you know Luke?
I know the name. I don't know him personally.
Yeah. His wife is my publisher and he's a dear friend. One of the great writers in Nashville, and he just can turn a groove into something that feels good. When you can match the groove side of what you're doing to the emotion in the words, then you've won, right? I normally can't do that unless somebody else in the room is doing it for me. And I run out of words if it's just joy. I'm happy in real life.
It's really interesting. I was writing with a couple people over Zoom the other day, and and while we were writing, one of the guys in the writing session was demoing the song in GarageBand, kind of in real time, and working out the groove. And it just went to like, it went into a completely different thing than I had sort of envisioned when we started. It's wild how that works.
It's so wild, and also like, I mean, to bring up Humble and Kind again, when I sing it, it's like a tiny little simple song that I wrote for my five kids. And when Tim McGraw sings it, he saw it in such a bigger way. Like I could not believe what he did with that song, even though technically it's the same song. It's right. A much different song when he sings it. That's one thing, and there's so many, but one thing I just love about music, like think of how awesome that is, that we get to do something that we can see one way and someone else can come in and see it totally different. And like for me, like with Dave Cobb, is to find somebody that sees it the same way that I do, but then bring it to the next level.
Right.
What he does, like, oh my God, you just, that's like the greatest feeling, you know?
How did you two find each other?
So that was through my manager, Beth Laird, Luke's wife, who's my manager. I write for Creative Nation. It's their company. And she's my manager. And one of the first meetings we had when I signed over there was, you know, when are you going to make another record? And at that point, I wasn't sure if I was going to be honest or not. Or it was not like at the top of my list of things, because I didn't know if it was adding up to much. I don't like being in the, at that point, I didn't like being in the studio at all. Right. The last two records I had made with Mark Arelli, who's my guitar player and dear friend, and I call him my little brother, but he's not, but, and we had cut live, and I knew I liked cutting live better than like the click tracks and the pulling, like just, oh, like, you know, like staying in like all those spaces. And I knew I liked cutting live for that reason. But I wasn't sure if it was helping me. And in the first like breakfast meeting Beth and I had, I flew into Nashville and she was like, I think you should make another record. What do you think? And I'm like, I don't know. It's not the top of my list. And she's like, well, who would you want to work with if you could work with anybody? Who would it be? And I was like, I don't know. And she said, what about Dave Cobb? I'm like, he doesn't know who I am. Like, he would never. And she's like, let me call him. And so she did. And I don't know, a couple months later, I'm like sitting in his house, like having a quick little meeting with him. And I don't know if I can do anything other than the way his process works now, because this is the third record we've done in the same format. Is just, I don't know why I trusted him like the minute I met him, but I did. And like, I have like 150% trust for him. Like if I look at him and he says, that's right, then I know it's right. And just being able to play with that band and cut everything live and just play the song like you're just enjoying playing your song. You're not making a record. You're
right,
playing
right.
Music together. And that's like, oh.
And playing with those guys, I watched the video for from your new record. And when I listened to the song, just audio, I was like, that's definitely Chris Powell. I know that's Chris Powell. Like he's just, there's something about the way that guy plays drums, but all of them, Brian, you know, the whole crew in there, and Dave too. I mean, yeah. God, it's just such an amazing group of people to work with.
So special. And Brian too, like just all of them. And then Philip came in, thank God he was available and came in and just, I don't know. It's just a joy. Like it's not, you know, and the thing about Dave is he's not gonna, you know, like beat his head against the wall if something's not working. It's just like, okay, let's like walk out of the room. Like it's very sort of like vibe wise, right? It's like walk out of the room, walk back, go have a glass of wine, come back, go eat. Let's go eat or come back. You know what I mean? Like if this isn't right now, it's not going to be right now. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
I just have a joyful time with them. It's so great.
Yeah, it's really interesting, you know, because I made a couple records. I mean, that's how I discovered your music was through Dave. Because the first time I went out there to make a record was a few years ago, and he had just made The Bird and the Rifle with you, and he played me some songs off it. I was just like, what? But it was interesting because I'd never in my life, I've been making records a long time, I never made a record like that where you're playing live and, you know, just doing a few takes and really keeping it. It's simple and in the room in that way. And I found myself having to, like, I was the only guy in the room stressing out. And I was like, why? I need to really, like, reconfigure my approach right now, you know?
Yeah, it's really, he's like a master of, I think it's probably like attention-based, but he lives in the space in front of him, right?
Right, right.
And I don't know, like, I remember the first record we made at his house, we made in the studio at his house. And there was one day there was a tech like a problem with gear. And I've been in the studio so many times where that will just shut everything down, or somebody's mad or somebody's pissed, and they walk through the room and you can just feel it. And I'm not like a super vibey person, but that stuff will just, it just sits everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And there was one day, there was like one problem with the mic, and he looked at Matt. It was Matt. And he looked at Matt. It was like it wasn't working or something. And he looked at Matt. He goes, "All right, we'll figure it out tomorrow." And that was it. And it was right. Like, I was like, I love these people.
Right. Aren't you supposed to have a temper tantrum right now? You're the producer.
I'm like, wait. And I had, this was like the one, it wasn't even probably a big deal, but it was the one little thing that wasn't perfect, right? And I was waiting to see, oh, what's the guy going to do now? And it was like, cool, we'll do it tomorrow. we'll call him tomorrow.
It's funny, you know, the last record I made with him, I made in two different, like I went out there for a week and did all the basics, came back, did all the overdubs, you know, a couple months later. And we were trying to like match a guitar tone to change something on one of the things. And it just wasn't quite there. And I don't even think he was in the room. I think he was maybe in the other room getting a cup of coffee or something. He came in and he just went, "Oh, let's just do this." And he just pressed record and I just played it. And then he went out and it sounded completely different than what we had already done. And it just sort of popped in for a second. And he was like, he goes, "I love shit like that." I'm like, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's capture the vibe. It's not about the perfection of the details.
And my music lends itself to that because it's so simple. You know what I mean? And I think he just makes it more, beautiful, and he brings it to life in a way that's really special.
This new record of yours sounds, it's the sound of it, production of it sounds a little different than the last two to my ear. It sounds a little more like, I don't know, sparkly room mic, kind of maybe a little more lush.
Here and there. Lush was that, was, like, totally
was that like intentional?
I don't know if it was intentional in the regards, it was a little bit more bird and rifle to me than the tree was. The tree was really sort of acoustic and didn't have as much piano based, you know, things in there too. Maybe because we didn't have Philip Towns with us and we did this time, but I did want more keyboard. And in my band, I have this amazing band up here in Boston that I get to tour with. And I have my keyboard player, his name is Jamie Edwards, is just a master of all things. So when I went in to Dave, I was like, I want to have a little bit more keyboard, a little bit like, which we did have in The Bird and the Rifle, to some extent, but it all sort of gelled and we were in the big room. We were in Studio A again. So I think it was like a little bit more Bird and the Rifle, but we didn't cut Bird and the Rifle there. So it was like the mix of the studio, the big studio, and then going back to that sound a little bit.
Now I read something on your Wikipedia page, which is like 9 times out of 10 means it's not true, but I just had to ask, is it true that you started writing songs as like lullabies for your kids or something?
Well, I started writing songs when I was little, but I did sort of kick into the exercise of writing a lot when my kids were babies. And I would like sit in their room when they went to bed. We had a 2-bedroom house, but one of the bedrooms was really big. And we had all 3 of the boys, our oldest boys, in that one room. Mm. And like one was in a crib, one was in a bed. Like they were all different ages, like in this one room. And I would just sit on the floor and, you know, come out 4 hours later. Like I'm going to go put the kids to bed at 7 o'clock.
Oh my God. My kids are teenagers now. So it feels like it's been a really long time, but God, I remember those years when they were babies. Putting your kids to bed is such a production. And the minute you get them all in bed, you walk out, and then all of a sudden one of them's right behind you.
What are you doing? Exactly. So instead of like giving them the option of walking out of the room and following me, I just sat there. And that's when I really just started writing a lot. Still didn't think for a long time, for years anyway, that I would leave the house with the songs. But that's when it really became something that I love to do, that I got to do often. I didn't, you know, take it quite as seriously until then.
Well, it begs the question then, do your kids listen to your music and heed your advice? Because a lot of your songs are sort of like, it's an adult reflecting on their children or an adult reflecting on their parents and maybe their parents' younger lives, or maybe it's just, you know, some cross-generational, you know, narrative throughout it. Like, do your kids listen to your stuff and go, all right, mama, yeah, I hear you. I am humble and I am kind and I'm gonna walk the line here.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
Because I feel like my kids don't take my advice, or at least not to my face. Maybe ultimately, I don't know.
No, they don't take me seriously. I literally had a meeting with my business manager one day, and she was like, "Well, your touring company," and I was like, and I went home. I was talking to my husband's name's Gene. I'm like, "Well, the touring company." He goes, "What company?" I'm like, "My touring." He's like, "You have a company?" I'm like, "Yeah, I have a company." It's not this big joke, but my kids also weren't. I say that's why I always joke about humble and kind, because I literally wrote it just for them, and then it became this thing that we were so blessed with. But when the first time they heard McGraw sing it, I was like, "Are you hearing the words now?" Because I know you don't hear them. I know they don't listen to them but I can't. You can't make your kids think you're cool, no matter what.
No. No, I believe you me. I'm like, I'm a guy in a big rock band. I'm like cool dad. My kids are like, well, you know, it's interesting with your songs, because there's a lot of songwriters, great songwriters, their songs are relatable one way or another, where you sort of see yourself in the story of the song. Your songs have this sort of next level magic to them for me, where they're not even close to my life story, and yet when I listen to them, I'm totally in it. I'm like committed. You know what I mean? I'm drawn in. I'm part of it. You know what I mean? And that's like such a special thing for a songwriter. Like, I don't know how else to even ask, but like, how do you do that? What are sort of your craft? Do you have like guidelines? Like, again, I was writing with some folks the other day, and they were, you know, as we're writing the song, there's things come up like, we need to make this part a little more relatable. We need to make this part a little tougher, you know, stuff like that. Are there like, I don't mean like rules, nothing restrictive, but are there some sort of like guiding light principles of songwriting that you kind of keep you grounded in a way?
Yeah, I mean, I think from, it's funny because you say that, thank you. I'm glad that you do, that you see that in there, which is such a blessing. But like, I grew up listening to, like, how did I identify with Springsteen when I was like an 18-year-old girl, like trying to go to community college, you know what I mean? It was like, what's happening? But I think that is like I think that's emotion. Like, that's the emotion in the song. And I am obsessed sort of with Springsteen, and I think he's a genius. But the thing that I love about songs that I'm drawn to, and I think the way that my brain likes to work, is to like describe the room in great detail, so the person has to, the listener has to figure out what's happening in the room. You know what I mean? Almost like, and I think it might lend more space for somebody to see themselves in it, or at least understand the character. Maybe I do love character songs, and a lot of songs there's a piece of a character and then a piece of myself. But I think, you know, if you have like you say 3.5 minutes to get your point across, and you put in as much truth, whether it is completely character driven or about yourself, if you put in the most truth possible in those 3.5 minutes, then people hear truth. Maybe, I don't know, you know, like, I think like, I have a song called Number Doors. It's from a couple records back, and it's really sad. And it's like, one of my sons, I remember him asking me when he heard it, he's like, "Why does it have to end so sad?" And the girl dies in the song. And the reason that she had to die in the song was because I, for some reason, at the beginning of the song, I'm following the song. And for some reason or another, the beginning of the song, her dad walks her down the aisle. And then I realize at some point that if she dies, her dad can walk her down the aisle again. Mm. So therefore she had to die. My son, who's like 12 at the time,
had to die, son.
Like, why does it have to be so sad? And I was like, it wasn't really all my fault. It's like, when that idea presented itself, it needed to be written that way.
Was that one of the songs that your manager was like, I think we're going to earmark that for your record?
This was before I met Dave Cobb. So this was before Beth was managing me. But yeah, that would be one that where they would say, I don't think this isn't pitchable.
I wanted to ask you one last thing about the Love Junkies. Can you tell me about the Love Junkies? Who are the Love Junkies? What is this, a songwriting collective, or do you guys make music together as the Love Junkies? Or is that like, I didn't know if that was a band, which if it is, I couldn't find anything recorded by you, but I know it's your friends, Hillary and Liz, that you write with a lot. So is that like, are those your main songwriting partners?
Yeah. I mean, they're my group of like my top, handful of people that I run to when I have something that I can't finish or that I love to write with the most when we're writing for other people. But it's Hillary Lindsay and Liz Rose and myself. And we honestly, it was a joke. We were talking about another group of songwriters in Nashville that had a name, and I don't even remember what the name was. And we were like, we need a name, and I don't know where we even came up with Love Junkies. I think we were trying to get a rhyme or something. But we were writing the songs Sober, which Little Big Town ended up cutting. But that was the first song the three of us wrote together. And the thing about us is we're each about 8 years apart, and I'm in the middle. And Liz is a grandmother now, and she has three kids and two grandchildren. And I have, my five kids all over the place, all different ages. And then Hillary has a young daughter, a four-year-old. And so we're all at these different parts of life as women. And we all have really different ways of approaching things just on a life scale. But we respect each other like crazy. And as far as songwriters, we all have different strengths and weaknesses. Although Hillary doesn't have a lot of weaknesses. So I always have to add that one. She doesn't have a lot of weaknesses. But Liz is just a lyricist, like genius, and can juggle a million things and do a million things at the same time. And I'm sort of more focused and like sort of, I have a lot of like deficiencies that I'm working with. And Hillary's just off doing, she's kind of a superstar. She can sing like you can't imagine. And but we work really well together because whatever one is needing strength in, the other can provide. And we write really, really well together. So we usually spend 3 days together and we just write as many songs as we can. And and I was really blessed with this record because I knew When You're My Age to be the first single, and I knew that I wanted them to sing it with me. And we also knew that a bigger artist probably wasn't going to cut it, at least at this point. It's a 5-minute song.
It's epic.
It's a long song. It was discussed, it went through a couple of people in Nashville of like, who love the song, but commercially it's just a difficult song for someone to present. And so when it came time for me to make the record, I just went to them and said, I know we really want more ears to hear the song, and it would be great if a big artist would do it, but will you let me do it? And they were like, absolutely. And we wrote that together and cried when we wrote it, because it's just such a kid, like just thinking about all of our kids. And and then they got to sing, they came in and sang it with me. And and it was just I had so much fun. I talked to Hillary about this the other day, and she was saying, that last day in the studio, Laurie, I've never seen you so like happy in your own music as that day. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't even think of that. And it was just so joy. Like, it was like the last day they came in, Like, everyone was there, and like we were playing songs for Anderson came in to listen. And it was nice. She's like, I've never seen you so happy in your own music. And if you can get that moment with a group of people that you've been able to write these songs with or sing or play them with, or even just ears that you admire that listened, I mean, that's the best thing,
That's the dream, right?
Dream. Like, when we were in LA and we got to hear some of the tracks on the record that y'all were doing, it's like, that's like, those things you don't forget,
Yeah.
But the Love Junkies are they're my girls. They're special.
I have to ask, is Liz Rose in any way related to, what was Hank Williams' publisher? Was it Fred Rose in the Legendary?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think
okay.
So. Yeah.
I didn't know if it was from that lineage.
She has a daughter named Caitlin Rose, who you've probably heard of. She was a brilliant Americana artist. Like, so good. Like, you got to check her out. She's so good.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Lori. I really appreciate it. I've been, like I said at the beginning, I've been wanting to interview you for a long time. And one of these days, I'm going to bother you to help me write a song, if you'd be so willing.
I would love that. Thank you for talking to me and listening to the music. And just, it's great to hang out and listen.
I didn't want to freak you out, but I'm such a fanboy. I'm like totally obsessed with your records. I just love your work. All right, that was Lori McKenna on Walking the Floor. Don't forget her new record, The Balladeer, comes out on July 24th. So go pre-order that thing right now. And when you're done with that, get on over to walkingthefloor.com, where I will post links to whatever the heck we just talked about. And then I will be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode. So in the meantime, wear those masks, wash those hands, keep a safe distance from each other, and stay safe out there, people. Adios, amigos!